1947, NASA launched the last of America's deep space probes. Aboard this compact starship, a lone astronaut, Captain William Buck Rogers, was to experience cosmic forces beyond all comprehension. In a freak mishap, his life support systems were frozen by temperatures beyond imagination. Ranger 3 was blown out of its planned trajectory into an orbit 1,000 times more vast, an orbit which was to return Buck Rogers to Earth 500 years later.
Okay, Buck.
Welcome to the Aaron Gray fan cast.
Yeah. That's our surprise.
Yep, we're changing the podcast. Just going to talk about the wonder and beauty that is Aaron Gray.
Yeah, that is Buck Rogers and Aaron Gray and Princess Adala.
Yeah. In her hats.
Yeah, sexy time.
Yeah, so I got a relatively inexpensive laptop that I was going to use to record today, but I realized right before we're going to start recording that the audio was picking up from the built-in mic.
Yeah.
Not my headset, so I got to play around with that. And
Is it a new laptop or
Yeah, it's new. I mean, I was gonna get just a Chromebook, like a small laptop, just for sitting on the couch and while I'm watching TV and stuff.
Yeah.
And then, but I decided to spend just like about $100 more and get a Windows laptop, even though I didn't really want to deal with Windows 8.
You could have got one of those Windows things that has all of them in one.
Yeah, I thought about that too, but I basically wanted something inexpensive, but with the Chromebook, I would be limited in some things that I could do, and if I spend a little bit more, I might be able to do most of the things that I do in computing right now without spending a lot of money, and then...
Yeah, gotta get that porn. It's gotta be handle the porn.
Yeah, I wasn't sure about the video capabilities of, of the Google Chromebook, so... Yeah, so... Down the road, I would like to get an actual nice quality laptop. You know, with the wedding and other things this year, I think I'll wait to spend a lot of money on a computer.
Yeah. I'm about ready to upgrade, too.
Yeah. So, and it's actually because of the way that upgrades happen. I mean, it's actually not... It's not that. It's a little less powerful than my desktop, but not much.
Mm.
So, it could stand as my main computer for a little while. So we'll see. But yeah, I tested the sound and it didn't sound the way that it would sound when I test the sound when I'm plugged into my desktop, and I realized it was picking up the volume from the built-in. So maybe next time I'll get it figured out. But it does have a video camera on it.
Oh no,
a webcam. So I immediately, when I was playing with the settings, I immediately disabled that on there because I know how you like to do.
Yeah, like I don't want to see that.
I know how you like to surprise me. So.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to. This last one you did before on my desktop, there's no camera, so I don't have to worry about you seeing me, but
yeah,
now there is. So.
I can take control of it if you have a camera.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing I know, I'm seeing things that I'll never be able to unsee.
That's right. So how have you been?
Pretty good. The first week after we last recorded, the first of the 2 weeks was a little crazy because I worked that Monday, and then but I left early because the storm, we had a storm coming in, and Tuesday I didn't work Tuesday or Wednesday because of the snowstorm that we had came in, and we got like a foot of snow. And it wasn't just a snow, but it was a combination of snow, wind, and the wind chill making temperatures like 20 or 30 below zero. And the wind was making really low visibility. So I didn't work for a couple days. And then when I went back to work Thursday and Friday, I went back to work with a cold that had me pretty out of it. And Saturday, that following weekend, Saturday was pretty out of it and started to feel a little bit better Sunday. So this past week I've been kind of recuperating, and towards the end of the week I've started to feel back to normal. But
well, that's good.
Yeah, so it's kind of a crazy week and crazy start to the year, but other than that, things have been pretty good.
Yeah. On our end, Harley had a growth on her ear, and it's not cancerous, but they want to remove it, so she's going to have the Victorian collar for a while.
Oh, man.
I'm not looking forward to that with Harley.
The lampshade, yeah.
Yeah, the lampshade.
Last time I took Luna to the vet, we saw two dogs with those. When we were going out, there was a little tiny dog that had them, had it. But then while I was there sitting and waiting for Luna, a woman came and picked up her dog, and that dog was maybe Harley size or a little bit bigger, so it was a really big lampshade.
Yeah.
And the poor dog came around the corner, bam, knocked the lampshade into the table with the brochures, and then they were taking her out the door, bam, knocked the lampshade into the door.
Yeah, that's rough.
Because, you know, they're used to their own size. And
yeah, imagine putting a lampshade on your head.
I know. I don't have to imagine. That's how I spent most of my college days.
Oh, with the lampshade? That's it. Just wearing a lampshade.
There goes that naked. Lampshade with a naked man body attached to it again.
That's right. You're trying to impersonate the lampshade in the Christmas story, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, except for it was two hairy legs instead of one shapely woman leg with the high heels on.
That's right.
Well, there were still the high heels, but just the legs were hairy.
Mm-hmm. So, you did your homework.
I did my homework this time, so now I can say why I didn't do it last time. I ordered the DVD set, and I went to do my homework and realized that instead of a disc one, I had two disc fives. So I was able to fortunately return that for a full refund and got a new set. And this time I have a disc one. So I was able to...
Is it the same set? It's just a better one, or is it a different set?
No, you know, I just, to hedge my bets, because originally I ordered the older edition of the DVDs where they released all, you know, the entire series in one set on six double-sided discs.
Yeah.
And so that's what I originally ordered because it was the same price as when they reissued them, I think, 2 years ago. They reissued them in two sets, one for season one and one for season two. And each of those was the same price as the original set. So effectively would be half the cost. But when I ran into that issue, I just went ahead and hedged my bets and ordered the season one of the new edition. So it's pretty much the same. It's like the same cut, same, you know, same quality and everything like that. It's just instead of, I guess they took them and put them on single-sided discs instead.
Yeah, I didn't realize they were a flip.
Yeah, so
disc. I have that set.
Yeah. So that ordeal is over with, and I was able to do my homework this time.
Right on. So instead of doing, we're doing something a little different. We are going to be doing the season one of Buck Rogers. And
Yeah.
if you keep wanting to go, I'll do season two too. I don't remember it that fondly, season two, but season one
Yeah.
is a lot better.
Yeah, I get the impression that that's the general consensus, but we can see how it goes.
So.
Now this is something because these came out around when I was born, so this is something that you grew up with.
Yeah, this is something that I came home from school. What year was this? I don't remember. 87?
79, I think it said.
79, Jesus.
Yeah.
1979. God dang. So I was about 10 years old.
And
Depending on when it came out. And
that was the year I was born.
yeah, there you go.
Well.
So I can't remember if God, I can't remember if I saw this at the theater. I think it was just says it was released to TV, all the research I've done, but I could have sworn that I went to the drive-in and saw it. But maybe I'm thinking of Battlestar Galactica. Maybe that one was released at the theater and then it became a series. But yeah, I love this.
No, I think you're right. I think it's I think what we watched, which was the first two episodes of the TV show, were actually there might have been a slightly different cut. They might have made a few changes and stuff, but I'm almost positive that what we watched was originally released to the theater.
Yeah, I'm pretty
And
sure
then
that I saw it.
yeah.
'Cause it was like one of those ones that wasn't like a big movie opening up, but it was like the second feature. Yeah. It was.
Yeah, back then in the yeah, 'cause back then in the drive-in days, they would have a lot of stuff would run as a second feature for a while. After it, maybe it might start as a second feature, it would run as the second feature. After it had run for a while as the first feature. So, but
This I had fond memories of, and I was a little bit worried about going back to something that you like and then saying, "Oh, that just didn't stand up." But for me, I enjoyed the hell out of it, and I don't know if it's just because of the retro aspect of it, going back home to something that I really loved. But God dang, I loved it in so many different ways. Even its cheesiness, I loved. There's some one-liners that I thought were so funny, and the women have to be like the two sexiest women that were on TV at that particular time. At least to me, they were. And Erin Gray is still hot, I think. She
Oh
aged
yeah,
well.
definitely. Yeah, I took a bunch of notes, and most of my notes are just one-liners that I wrote down real quick so that I would remember them.
Yeah, I saw this a little bit farther back than you did, like at least maybe 2 weeks earlier because of the disc thing, but I
Right.
remember everything pretty. Plus this is the like third time I've seen it. It just now that I'm seeing it when I'm much older. And this past weekend I had a chance to go see Gil Gerard, but I didn't get there. There was a lot more family things that I had to do, so I couldn't get to the convention. But I did see a little clip of, man, that was packed. It was like they tried to shove 5,000 people in a place that could only support maybe 2,000.
Oh man.
But I did see him, and man, he looked so different. Like, he wasn't what I expected. Like, some actors look a lot like that. Like, you go see Lou Ferrigno, Lou Ferrigno still looks like Lou Ferrigno. But Gil Gerard does look like he's gotten older. But I wanted to take my picture that I have signed with Erin Gray and then get one with him and then have them next to each other, but maybe there'll be a next time.
Yeah, there could be some other opportunities.
And then I went on a little thing where I was like, God, I would love to have these toys, but I tried to go find some of them and they were just either too expensive or too disjointed. In other words, I couldn't get what I wanted. Or they re-released some dolls that I'm thinking of getting, which is a Buck Rogers doll. I think it's a bigger doll and it's got Tiger Man. Tiger Man played a big part in this one. So,
Yeah, it was.
what did you think? Did you like say, what has Mike gotten me into here with this? Or I mean, it's like, did you enjoy it, or did you have to put your mind into someplace else, or what was it like?
No, I did definitely enjoy it a lot, actually. And I was just going to say briefly before I get into that, the only exposure, that I had, other than just being aware of the existence of Buck Rogers, is I did actually have a game when I was growing up, and I think, that I played quite a bit in middle school when I was into, like strategy games and stuff like that. It was put out by TSR in the 80s, 1988 specifically. It was designed by a dude that was Jeff Grubb, who's a dude that was pretty involved with Dungeons and Dragons. It was Buck Rogers Battle for the 21st Century game.
What, it wasn't the TV version, it was just Buck Rogers, right?
Yeah,
There
because
wasn't a
the
picture of Gil Gerard on the cover.
No, because there was, you had to pick the person that you were going to be. And the art on them they don't really look like they were based on the likeness of the actors at all. And it was a it was like an Axis and Allies or that kind of a strategy board game where you had like a lot of like, little plastic units and stuff. What's the more common not Axis and Allies but like the
You're asking
Risk.
the wrong people, wrong person.
Yeah. No, Risk is what I'm talking about. That's
Okay.
like the most common game of that type. But
I've never
this it
played
was
that, believe it or not. Never played Risk.
Yeah, I mean that's the closest like that some most people with these are, and then they would Axis and Allies and games like that are like a little bit more advanced version of that. And this game was advertised in comics a lot, though. A lot of people have probably, if they haven't seen this game, they've seen an ad for it in comics in the
Yeah, I
80s.
think I remember it.
Yeah. But it was a pretty cool game, and it did. It had, you could be Buck Rogers or Wilma Deering or Doc Huer, and were like the sort of good people, or you could be Ardala, Killer Kane, or Black Barney.
No
So
Tiger Man.
I think
I
Barney
don't
was
know why
like
you'd want to be anybody. Like, why would you pick Dr. Ewer? I mean, I just.
well, all based on, I guess,
What
so
you needed at the time?
yeah, I mean, well, each one of the different people had their own advantages. Like, I'm looking at pictures of the game, and his card, he's listed as a mechanical genius, so if you're him during the game, your spaceships move. Any spaceships that have him with them move extra 2 zones. Or like another example is Wilma Deering, since she's our favorite. She's listed as a blockade runner. So any of her troops, while they're with her, they're immune to different types of attacks.
Nice.
Anyway.
So the one thing that I didn't remember that surprised the hell out of me is I was so used to the da 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 you know the regular TV show series, and when this one opened up, it opened up like a Bond sequence, and the way they did it, I don't know,
Totally.
I the way they did it was like hilarious, because they show like Buck frozen, for 500 years. It's 1987. Was it 1987? I can't remember.
1979.
Was it 1979 though in the show?
Oh, you mean
in the series?
Yeah, like 87. Yeah,
it was like 1987. In the year is 1987, and then they're like, he's getting frozen in time, and then he's like totally frozen, and he's dreaming. He's dreaming of having sex with all these super sexy women, including Erin Gray, Adala, and a couple other women I've never seen before.
Yeah, I think they were just random hot chicks and they had huge 70s sunglasses on.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was a great opening. It was like totally a James Bond opening.
Totally, and the stuff that they're crawling around on were the words Buck Rogers.
Yeah, it was great. And then the other thing I didn't realize was that the theme that I know so well in my head had lyrics. Yeah. There were some guys singing words. I was like, what the hell?
Yeah, it was pretty hilarious, too. It's kind of an awesome song.
But if you're going to be frozen for 500 years, that's what I'd want to be dreaming about, I tell you that.
Yeah, it was, and it's funny because, you know, Erin Gray is, she's laying there in a bikini, you know, and then she like shakes her hair out all sexy, and then for the entire movie, she has like a full body combat suit on. I mean, it's a pretty tight combat suit, but it's still like a full body combat suit, and until like maybe 60% through the film, she's got her hair up tight in a bun, or she's got a like a Spaceballs helmet on her head.
Yeah.
So it's funny that she's like really scantily clad in the intro to the movie, and then unlike Princess Adala, she's pretty covered up throughout the film. But I mean, that is more in keeping with her character in the story. But yeah, I definitely got a you know, it's right around the same time. I definitely get a Han Solo vibe from Buck Rogers.
Yeah, real machismo type.
Machismo, kind of a smart ass.
Yeah.
You know, real kind of cocky about his abilities and stuff. But yeah, so you know, the premise that a lot of people would know, you know, he's frozen for 500 years, and you know, when he wakes up, he's in the custody of Princess Princess Ardala and Kane, who is her kind of
military advisor, I would say.
Yeah, military advisor, right hand man, kind of.
I think he reports to the father just like she does, because it seems like there's like a family. Like she comes from a family of a guy who kind of rules the galaxy, kind of thing, and he's got a lot of daughters. Like many daughters, and he deploys them to various places, I guess. and their whole ship, when they capture Buck, they're just on the way to Earth to do negotiations, when in reality they're there to try to take over. But they're disguising it like, oh, we'll help you with your you know, your shipments of products, because there's like a pirate infestation in space where a lot of the goods that are being shipped to Earth or sent from Earth are being hijacked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Kane is played by Michael Ansara. So, and he actually just passed away last year, it looks like, at the age of 91. But I like that, you know, because we already mentioned a lot of the other main actors. You know, Pamela Hensley is Princess Ardala. Erin Gray is Colonel Wilma Deering. And as you said, Gil Gerard is Buck Rogers. So,
the only other characters you really have are Tiger Man, who really doesn't say much, and then Dr. Ewer, who's like the scientist there, and then Twiggy, who's a robot companion that carries Dr. Theopolis on his neck.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like a lot of the brain trust are these little units that Dr. Theopolis is part of, whatever they are. They're just like circular mini computers that have a lot of power, obviously, because later in the show you see how they kind of rule at least the politics and the crime with on Earth.
Right, yeah, and a lot of, I noticed just from looking at IMDb that a lot of the stars of the early few episodes, the series ends up kind of mostly being Buck Rogers, Wilma Deering, Twicky, and Dr. Theopolis. Some of the other stars don't stay around for for as much of the series. Dr. Hewer is there a fair bit too, it looks like. But so the Ardala's people, the context that this is set up in, they're on their way to set up a alliance with Earth. And but their plan is to secretly, they're supposed to be, based on regulations and stuff, they're supposed to be coming unarmed. But they secretly have a lot of fighter jets and things like that that they're planning on actually taking over and betraying the alliance with Earth. So they Kane basically comes up with the opportunity of using Buck Rogers as a plant. They bug his ship so that they'll be able to get information from either they'll get information from Earth by sending them back if Earth just doesn't incinerate them, because you get the impression that Earth is pretty well guarded in their air, their the space around Earth is monitored really vigorously to prevent any kind of intrusion.
At least what's left of it.
Yeah, it's kind of dystopian. But I thought that the so you know my general over feelings is I do like things that it's kind of up my alley in some regards, because I like things that have some aspect of being tongue in cheek and don't totally take themselves seriously, but still are written well and are able to have a good emotional impact to them.
Yeah,
I
or in
mean,
a solid story, like something to
right.
keep your interest, even though it's got like some humor to it, and something that you, some things you know were meant to be cheesy. I mean, on purpose, on some in some instances.
Totally. And I like that unpretentiousness of I think that even comes down to in sort of the same way that why I like superhero comics. There's a bit of a lack of pretension, because on one level it's about superheroes. It's about people dressing up in costumes and fighting. So on a certain level, like, you can't act super pretentious about it. It doesn't take itself totally seriously. It might be tongue in cheek, but at their best, they can have a lot of emotion and they can really affect you and tell a meaningful story about, the human condition.
Right. So,
So,
one of
I would
the. Go
say
ahead.
that that, well, no, I was just going to say that I would say that there's a similar spirit to this.
Yeah, so before Kane puts his plot together, they awaken Buck, and he's kind of like in this state where his brain isn't all there, and he's got a migraine, and he asks for painkillers. And they immediately they inject him with something that may, it's like heroin or something. So he doesn't know like quite what he's doing.
It's pretty powerful. I almost thought that maybe it was because he's from, 1987, that it was a bit too powerful for his system,
Yeah.
He's pretty loopy and he likes it.
But it could be also that it's not made for the human because like they mentioned that Kane was from Earth, but like Adala and whoever her father is are not from Earth.
Right. That's right, yeah.
So these it's a Draconia ship that's coming to Earth. They're Draconians. And they set Buck up and they send him to Earth. And Buck is kind of drugged when he's first flying down there, and they're intercepted by William Deering and another pilot. Like, they're like, why is this ship coming down? Blah, blah, blah. It's intercepted. And they originally think of him as a threat, and he's like under guard like 24/7, almost all the time that he's on Earth initially.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the points at which I thought, you know, this is pretty well written, because I thought that they handled that whole sequence of him returning to Earth really smartly. Like, I didn't feel like anybody was acting in a way that didn't make sense. You know, though, they pick up, you know, they're monitoring the systems, and the woman that picks up his ship is a woman that normally, she's on a frequency that they normally don't have to bother monitoring, which, you know, makes sense to the fact that this is this old technology, this ship that's coming in, and she hears him singing. Like, Buck's just kind of, he's pretty relaxed and comfortable as an astronaut and stuff, and he's just he's singing to himself, and that's what kind of alerts them to the fact that something is strange going on. So I didn't feel like, obviously the story needs Buck to survive and get on Earth without being obliterated, or then the story's over, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't feel like that they were, like, just doing this cheap plot maneuverance. You know, I felt that they pulled it off in a way that the, like, Earth didn't look stupid or or illogical for letting him in.
The shuttle does look like the shuttle.
Yeah.
Just flying a space shuttle.
Yeah, I thought it was written well, and no one was acting, you know, stupid. So I was impressed with that, and that's kind of at the point where I was like, you know, this is written pretty well. So
when they're down there, something happens where they think that Buck is. Well, they actually constrain him the whole time, and he, like, wants to go out. He wants to show, like, William Deering the ship, and he's suspicious of something immediately. And he's like, you know, why does my ship have these laser, you know, burns on them? Why was I fired upon? I had no weapons. when the Draconians are supposed to be on a peaceful mission, you know, coming to Earth. So he's suspicious, and he's telling Wilma all this stuff. And she's kind of overwhelmed, and she doesn't know who to trust at the time. Like, who's this asshole? That's coming here and telling me how to run my job, and then trying to go places where he's not authorized to go.
Yeah, she's definitely suspicious. She's the most suspicious of him, but also at the same point, they definitely convey that she's, you know, she's affected by Buck Rogers in a way that she's not quite comfortable with and doesn't know how to deal with.
And I thought they did a good job of, like, you know, Buck's there, and he's still, like, in shock, like, what the hell's going on? But then allowing him to, like, leave the premises with Twiggy, because she actually wants to fire on him. Like, he's like, go ahead and shoot me if you don't want me to leave or whatever. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't shoot him. So he says he takes off to, like, the no man's land, or whatever they want to call it, which is outside the city, where everything's just burned and looks like a nuclear apocalypse has happened. And I think it's Chicago, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
It's Chicago, and he's going back to see, like, did this really happen, or what really happened, and to see what his, you know, places that he knew once, and his family, what happened to them. And he was going back there, and then it's kind of like, everything's destroyed, and there's these nomads that kind of are after technology, if anything. And he goes with Twiggy, so he's like a prime target. These post-apocalyptic nomads, I guess when they see Dr. Thalopoulos and Twiggy, they're like, well, that's a, you know, a lot of money to buy food or whatever.
Yeah, because they're scavengers, kind
of. Yeah.
Jumping back just a little bit, there was a couple notes I made in between here, where they initially have Buck Rogers in captivity in this kind of big white room and stuff, and that's where, you know, Dr. Huer comes in, and he introduces Buck to to Twicky and Dr. Theophilus, and I thought it was funny that as soon as Twicky walks in behind Dr. Hewer, Buck just looks at it and says, "What is that?" And then Dr. Hewer explains that, you know, who Dr. Theophilus is, and that Twicky's a robot that carries Dr. Theophilus around, and that Dr. Theophilus and the other intelligences like him basically control, you know, their society down even to the atmosphere. And Dr. Theophilus, I actually rewound it a couple times just so I could get the line down, because I just thought it was really amusing. He says, "I'm introducing a pale hint of mauve into the sunset this evening, not so deep as an amethyst, but the more subtle burn texture of cinnamon."
I remember that.
And Buck goes, "If I were you, I'd check into whoever's programming that thing." And then Dr. Hewer has to explain to Buck that Theophilus is not just a computer and he has feelings, and that he hurt his feelings.
It's like a mother box, man.
Yeah. So, but yeah, as you said, it is Chicago. Because eventually Rogers and Twiggy and Theophilus are over, they're getting cornered by the primitives and stuff, and you know, Rogers is fighting some of them using his hand-to-hand combat skills and stuff, but eventually gets to the point where they're about to be overwhelmed, and all of a sudden a starship comes into the sky and starts firing on the primitives and saves them. And
it's actually one of those mobile units, like a tank looking thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right.
But because yeah,
that was actually a toy.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, that little rover thing.
Cool. But yeah, it's Wilma Deering, and Buck's pretty impressed that she came to save him and stuff, and so he says, he compliments her by saying that it was very ballsy. And she says, "Very what?" And so he says, "Very good." And they ask him, you know, his thoughts about the area that he is. He says, you know, a little dig on the Windy City. He says, "It's a bit primitive, but then it is the south side of Chicago."
Yeah. And then after that, he kind of goes on trial. Like, they take him back, and he's on trial for being a spy. And what did he do that they made him suspicious? Didn't he do something?
Well, they found the equipment in his ship.
Oh, that's right. Kane had planted that transmitter. Mm-hmm. And that's what led them to believe he was a spy. So he went on trial in front of, like, all of these Dr. Thalopoulos, you know, boxes. And yeah, they do a good job, because, you know, there's the trial, and they make you, at least I thought they were going to say not guilty, because, you know, Thalopoulos kind of said, "I've done everything and this guy is a good man and I believe everything he says." And after all that, like, he was his defense attorney, and it didn't work. They found him guilty, and the punishment was death. Like, he was going to be put to death. And then Wilma comes to his cell and kind of says, you know, "Well, help me out. Help me, you know, go to the ship or whatever." And he's reluctant. Like, he's like, "Fuck you. You sent me to death. Why should I help you?"
Yeah.
But Buck realizes that if he goes, and he goes not as a prisoner, he could try to show his innocence, because he's been on that ship before. And he's seen the military, he's seen the ships, he's seen those dudes with the draconian pirate helmets, which they don't believe are draconians at the time. They think they're pirates. So
yeah, because Earth has been, for a while now at this point, been suffering a lot of pirate attacks.
Right.
They've had a ton of problems with pirates, but they don't know that there's any connection between the pirates and you know, our Dallas people.
So they get to go up there, the Earth ships get to go up there just to, as a show of, we just want to scope your stuff and make sure that you guys are secure and you're not attacked by the pirates. So they contact Adala and Kane and say, well, you know, we're going to come and just introduce ourselves and make sure that you guys are secure in case the pirates attack you.
And they get there and Ardala's wearing this first of many crazy outfits.
Oh my God.
They're like, they're super sexy, but they're also super crazy. Cause like she's basically wearing a purple bikini, but then she's got this whacked out collar that's just independent of the actual bikini top.
Yeah. It's not like, even connected.
Yeah. It looks like this gigantic flower petal or something like that. It's insane.
One thing I love though is she loves to show a lot of skin.
Yeah, she definitely does. I guess that's part of their culture or something.
Yeah, she wants to show everything she possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
And the one scene that I freaking love, like I even wanted to tell Gil Gerard about this scene, but it's when they board the ship and they're invited to this dinner.
Yeah.
And this dinner, they're having like a dance thing and everybody's paying their tributes to Adala, like, you know, bringing her gifts and all that. And Buck actually brings her flowers, you know, which I don't think she's ever gotten before. And she's like really sexually attracted to Buck. I mean,
mm-hmm.
she wants to, you know, get it on.
Yeah, and she's got a different outfit on at this point. She's got a white outfit on, and she looks super good in it, except for the hat is ridiculous.
It's got like horns, right?
Yeah, it's like this big white, like, it reminded me, if you ever watched the Flintstones, it reminds me of the hats that Fred and Barney wear in that group that they're a part of, like that, like,
yeah,
Lodge group.
The Lodge, yeah.
The Water Buffaloes or whatever they're called. It totally looks like that. It has these huge horns on it. So she looks like really good except for that hat. And unfortunately, she takes it off later. But
the scene that I just love is when he asks her to dance. So they have this weird dance. And the dancing reminded me a lot of that Heath Ledger film. Do you remember seeing that where he's medieval times, but they kept playing like Queen and stuff?
Yeah, it's kind of, it's this weird, it's like in the future, like ceremonial line dancing has come back, but it has like a futuristic twist to it. So people are doing, you know, weird movements with their hands and stuff like that, but it's still, it's very formal.
And it's very, very formal and slow.
Very slow. Yeah. Even though like the music, the dude is playing it on this like crazy, like
synthesizer key,
like kind of 80s looking, futuristic according to the 80s kind of looking thing. So it's all electronic, but it's like future classical.
And then Buck goes to the DJ and it's like, this ain't my music. Can you play some rock and roll?
And he's like, what?
And then he's like, he does like some new wave stuff or something.
He's like, you know, and he just like snaps his fingers, like kind of fast, and the guy tries to do it, and he's like, no.
Says, let it go.
Yeah. Let yourself go loose, and the guy just starts like going nuts, and he's like, yeah, there you go.
And they start doing the Buck dance, and they're like dancing, and everybody like pulls aside, and Adala and Buck are there on the dance floor, and they're dancing away. And then they get into each other's business while they're dancing, and like it starts to get sexier.
He
get
goes together. He's so everyone's just standing there still, looking at him, like, what the hell is this guy doing? And he's like, he's dancing backwards while he's still looking at Ardala, and he's just kind of like shaking. He's like, and she's like, what are you doing? And he says, It's called getting down. So like people start to get into it, and Ardala is like, she's totally feeling it because she's very like sensual and she's into him and everything like that. And she goes, you know, they're dancing real close, and she says, what if we bump together? And he says, we automatically become man and wife.
And then while this is happening, you know, they're starting to dance a little more sexy and closer to each other. They start a little far apart. And then as they're dancing, it gets closer and closer, and it starts to become sexual. And then you see Erin Gray, the camera goes off to her, and then you see like an element of extreme jealousy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she says, That's disgusting.
And I think I told that out of sequence because I think before that happened, they had the fight scene in space where the pirates actually attacked the ship.
Yeah, I think
Right?
something like that, yeah. But yeah, I mean, you got the basic gist there.
But the pirates attacking the ship reminded me like a lot of Star Wars kind of thing when they're just taking out all the Earth ships. But it's like they basically see all these pirate ships and the Draconians are acting like that they're not their ships, but those Draconian pirate ships are actually launching out of their bays. And when Buck Rogers and them go to defend the Draconian ship, they go out there with like, I don't know, six ships, and they go try to fight the Draconians, and their ships are armed with the computers, like kind of like the R2D2s, and they mostly fly by computer rather than manual. And Buck is just going out there just to go out there, I guess, so they can keep an eye on him. But and he's told not to engage the enemy. And they go on these flight patterns at the computers, and the Draconians are just picking him off like flies. And Buck is like trying to give verbal guidance to the team, all the pilots, trying to tell him how to survive and what to, go right, go left, do whatever they need to do. He's using like pilot terms, which they probably don't even know. Like they're on 12 o'clock, and they're like, "What the fuck is he talking about?" And he decides to go to manual mode, and no, they're just pick. They pick up every ship except for Wilma Deering and his ship. But he actually she could have died, right? Because she wanted to fly manual. I mean, not manual, but with the computer.
Yeah, and so the context that provides the context for the celebration and the dance and everything is to celebrate the victory, because our Dallas people are still pretending that that they have nothing to do with the pirates, and so they turn the occasion into to their advantage by by crediting Buck Rogers with his with the victory, and with and they credit him with saving them and everything like that. And this is also, like you said, when around the time that Ardala really truly becomes not just visually attracted to Buck Rogers, but also she's impressed with his masculinity and his willpower, and she starts to contrast him with Kane, who she sees as just totally beholden to her father, who she's not too, too favorable on, because we find out that he has 29 other daughters. So she has 29 sisters, and she's just the first in line, but she has, 29 other sisters that would like to see her bumped off so they can move up in their status. So, throughout the story, from the Earth people's perspective, is Buck Rogers a traitor or not? Is he whose side is he on? And as you said, Deering is also falling for Buck, but she's the contrast to Ardala. She's a lot more conservative and not used to showing her feelings and stuff, but she gets so jealous during the dance and everything. And Buck, we get the impression, I mean, he's doing all of this because he knows that Ardala is up to something, so he wants to get close to her, but no one, he's the only one that knows that. Deering, finally, her jealousy pushes her to the point that she kisses him,
Actually, though, suggests
I
that they
think.
go somewhere.
And then, yeah, and then suggests that they, go back to her place or
Because I
whatever.
remember watching that as a kid. I mean, I think my hormones were starting to kick off, and I was like, "How could you turn that down, Buck? How could you turn that down?" I would have been so weak with that, like he was real focused at the time because he's still trying to prove the Draconians are up to something, and he asks Twiggy. He's like, "God, my head's hurting. Can you get me some of those painkillers?" And he's asking for those painkillers for a reason, because he sets up during that after the dance, he sets up this engagement with Adala. Like, let's meet up, and that gets all set up, and that gets set up without Deering's knowing of that is going to happen, I believe. But she actually sends Twiggy, I think, to spy on Buck, like, let me know what he's doing at all times. So he's looking at his watch, like, hey, I gotta get going, instead of saying, God, I could get it on with Wilma here.
No, 'cause he knows that if he doesn't prove that they're guilty, he's dead. So he's got a and he but he's got a great line when he's turning her down. He says, I've been out of it for a while, 500 years. I've got to go easy on reentry."
It's ridiculous. And then there was one scene, I don't remember exactly where what had happened. I think it happened prior to what we're talking about now, but Twiggy actually says, "What an attractive man you are, Buck." Hilarious.
Yeah, and he says Twiggy. So yeah, every once in a while, a lot of times Twiggy talks just like I did at the beginning of the show, beady beady beady,
It means something. At least Thelopolis knows what that means.
yeah, Theopolis can. But every once in a while, he'll also say something in English. At one point, he sees Princess Ardala, and he says, "Beady beady beady, what a body." And he says something early. I forget what he says, but Buck tells him, "Don't think thoughts like that. It'll run down your batteries."
It's funny because initially, early on, like halfway through the movie, he doesn't say much. Like he's talking just to Thelopolis. Like he knows that, Buck is not going to understand. But as the episode keeps on going and going, he starts saying more. I should be like beady beady beady, say some wise ass remark.
Yeah, it's almost like they reconsidered halfway through the script and like realized that they could use him to make funny jokes. So they'll say like, "Well, maybe he will speak English once in a while." But so Buck's on the ship and he basically, he's playing Ardala, telling her that that he's willing to go along with her, and she reveals her plan that she wants to rebel against her father, and she wants to use Buck and his proactiveness to go against her father so that she doesn't have to deal with her the you know with the other sisters behind her and her succession and stuff. She wants to create her own dynasty basically without her sisters being involved, without her father. And so he plays along with it. There's a bedroom scene between the two of them. I guess I'm trying to think, because he ends up knocking out Tiger Man,
Yeah,
and
well, he
putting
actually
Tiger Man in
drug.
his bed.
Yeah, he
Or not.
actually gets her to drink wine.
Oh, right, he poisons her
He that's
mind.
what he actually poisons her, so he can escape and go look at the ships or go find what he needs to find. And that's before they have sex. Like it looks like they're gonna have sex, but he like spikes her wine. And
And
then
she
what he
passes
does,
out.
then what this fucker does is Tiger Man is like her bodyguard. He doesn't leave her side. Like, so she's in a room. He'll be standing right outside that room. That's his whole goal, is to guard her, protect her. And he runs across him, and they get into a rough fight scene, and he knocks Tiger Man out. And what does he do? He grabs Tiger Man and throws him in the bed with Princess Adala. And then he takes off.
And so, yeah, so that when she does wake up, she thinks it's him at first, and then she sees Tiger Man in bed with her and
Yeah,
starts
she's ready
freaking
to
out.
start kissing his ear and get all over him, and it's Tiger Man. He's like grinning, like, And then she starts screaming at for Kane, like, help! Like, help! It's
And
like a Keith's house. Help!
and Twiggy and Theophilus are also on the ship, and they actually see Buck dressed up in the uniform of one of the enemy soldiers, so they at first think that he actually is a traitor and gone over to the other side, and so they're planning on taking him down for the sake of Earth and approach him. And he's like, "What the hell are you doing?" he yells at them and tells them, what's really going on, and so gets them on his side. As his plan is to put an explosive in the tailpipe of the of all of their ships, so that when they actually go to attack Earth, all of their ships will explode instead. I think, I don't have a whole lot of notes from this point on. I think basically the plan ends up being successful. We finally get to see Princess Ardala's father. He's kind of on like a, like a 3D vid screen kind of thing, talking to Kane
Like
and
a Fu
yelling at him.
Manchu type guy.
Yeah, he looks his style. I mean, he's not, thankfully, he's not as scantily clad as his daughter, but like the weird fashion that she has of her helmets and her hats and stuff like that are kind of reflected in his kind of, he has a really kind of strange outfit on him too. You get a sense that that's kind of the style of their people or something. But Ardala, fortunately, throughout these sequences and stuff, she still got the white outfit on, but she loses the helmet, so she looks a lot better. And actually, like I was saying, the first time that we even see Erin Grey with her hair down is at that celebration dance.
Yeah, when she gets jealous and goes after Buck.
Yeah.
But the main fight scene is pretty cool because the finale, Buck destroys a lot of ships. Like all those Draconian ships are being launched towards Earth. They're in attack mode. But as soon as they leave the bay, they explode. Then one or two of them might get out, but Buck managed to put these bombs in the majority of them, and then Twiggy and Theophilus think he's betraying them, but they manage to call Wilma, tell her what they're doing. Wilma sends the ships back up, and the pilots are like, "What do we shoot at?" Because the ships are blowing up as soon as they leave the bay. And they start focusing on the main ship, and the main ship is in total disarray. It's getting blown up, like it's gonna destruct, kind of like the Death Star,
Yeah.
it's getting ready to blow up. And I think Kane grabs Adala, and then they go into an escape ship, and they leave. And then Buck and Twiggy are stuck on the ship, and it looks like they're gonna die. But Wilma ends up landing the ship and then rescuing Buck Rogers and Twiggy.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah, and they say they're talking about Ardala at this point, and what happened to her and everything, and because people are realizing that that Buck was going along with everything, and that he'd been scheming all along back at the dance and getting on her good graces and stuff. But he says, I would say she had the nicest set of thorns at the ball. And Twiggy says, "It was a nice hat." But yeah, I was pleasantly surprised. I mean, I'm definitely someone that is I'm pretty forgiving about special effects. I'm definitely okay with watching stuff from the 80s or the 70s or even the 50s, 60s, whatever. If I feel like they did a good job with what they had at the time, I don't expect it to look like 2014,
Yeah, it wasn't bad
And
special effects. It was pretty good.
no, and as I said when we started out, I appreciate a certain amount of tongue-in-cheekness and campiness and a bit of you know, a bit of, I like when there's a little bit of a sense that it's not taking itself too seriously, but still want to tell a good story, a good entertaining story that has some emotional beats. And I found it surprisingly well written, because I felt like characters, you know, were established for who they are, and they weren't acting out of character. And you know, I felt like the show established its logic, and for the most part, you know, followed its logic and didn't just throw it out the window for plot reasons, you know, which so I thought it was neatly written.
I think the starship's designs are pretty neat too. Like the design of the Earth ships and the Draconian ships.
Mm-hmm.
They look distinctively different from, you know, like Star Wars or anything that we've seen before. And mm-hmm. I thought they had some unique designs to them, because, you know, the Viper in Battlestar Galactica looked a lot like the X-Wing fighter without the X-Wings. Do you know what
mm-hmm.
I mean?
Mm-hmm.
These ships look very flat, and they had a unique design to them. I liked them. Even the huge Draconian ship looked cool. And the way they designed the city that was remaining on Earth, you know, outside of Chicago, they basically called the area outside of the scorched earth, I think is what mm-hmm. they called it.
Yeah.
And that reminded me of Judge Dredd, because that's what they call it, I think.
Yeah, it's kind of a neat dystopia that I enjoyed, because you get the sense that, I think Dr. Heuer says something to the effect that, you know, we as humans really screwed things up. And especially when it comes to the environment. And it got to a point where, you know, we realized that we needed to trust things like the control of the environment and stuff like that to these intelligences like Dr. Theophilus, because we had messed things up so bad, we had no idea how to fix it. You know, and I thought that was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of, you know, dystopian society.
I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, me too.
Because unlike you, I already had it, so I didn't have to go out and purchase something. So I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, and it was still, I mean, it still was fairly expensive, but and I figure, you know, as long as I didn't hate it so much that I wanted to cancel the project, I would be getting getting my use out of it. And instead of getting it from Netflix and tying up a disc on my queue for months on end, you know. But yeah, I enjoy it. I mean, I'm looking forward to watching some more when I got done. I was ready to check out some more, so that's a good sign.
Cool deal.
I'll do some more next time.
You think we could take a quick break?
Sure.
I'll just put it on pause, and I'll be back in about, I don't know, 3 or 5 minutes.
Okay.
All right. We're back.
Back and bladdered emptied.
Yeah. So, I only read a couple of comics this past week, because I was out visiting family.
Mm-hmm.
I am in a weird mood, though, right now. God, it's like, I do not want to read new stuff. I'm in a, like, I have all this old stuff I'd rather be reading, and I don't know why it is. It's just weird. And then, you know, in a couple weeks from now, I'll be all into the new stuff again, but I go through, I am so, like, my mood swings on comics just changes dramatically.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the place I hang out, and almost the time is the past.
Yeah.
When it comes to comics, so. Yeah, I don't think we had, I know I didn't post asking for any questions or anything like that, so I don't know if you did, but.
No, I didn't. I forgot.
Yeah, that's fine.
So, but I did have a comic or a couple comics I wanted to talk about. The first, could I go first?
Absolutely.
All right. This is a series I'm not too. I don't remember being too fond of, but it was like a series that I wanted to complete, like just for the sake of trying to get every DC comic, my goal from 1973. And it was Fate. It came out of Zero Hour. This is where, Kent and Isa and Inza Nelson were aging terribly as a result, and they went back to their temple in Egypt, and there was a thief in there named Jared Stevens who was stealing stuff, and eventually he becomes the new Fate. And this new Fate is doesn't have a helmet. It's like he's empowered with Nabu daggers, a little ribbon that he wears around his arm, and maybe something else. They're like mystical artifacts from the helmet, and he's the new Fate, and he doesn't really know anything about his powers or his power set. And I went back and went to I had had issues 0 through 9 and wanted to finish the series. This is the a lot of series came out of Zero Hour, like Starman and a couple other series that came out, started with issue 0 and then continued on, and I think they had some fairly decent runs. This one went from this was from 1994 to 1996, and the issue I read was number 10. And it originally started off with John Francis Moore and Anthony Williams as the artist, and the inker was Andy Lanning. And then it went to Stephen Grant as of issue 5 and Len Kaminski. And then Anthony Williams stayed on as the artist. And this one has a very interesting cover, this issue 10. He's got a weird style to it. And I think you're going to either hate his artwork. Like, I don't think there's no middle ground. I think you're going to say, anybody that looks at this cover is going to say, I either really like it or I freaking hate it. But what it has is, it has Zatanna fighting this other I can't remember her name because she's just mentioned briefly in here, female character, and they're fighting in magic, and then it's got Fate in the background like burning up, and it's continued from the previous issue because in the previous issue I guess what he was trying to do, Fate was trying to stop a plane from crashing, and because he had a vision, like his powers are manifesting himself. He had a vision, tried to report it, but the plane blows up, and now the feds are looking for him. So he's being hunted down because he's being accused of knowing about the plane blowing up, and he's kind of like wanted by the law. And he's got like a an oracle of him, like of his own, where he's talking to the guy, and the guy's like, "Lay low, lay low." And he's like, okay, well, I think I'll lay low and I'll just go hang out and see a show. So he goes to see a Zatanna show. And Zatanna is acting kind of weird at this point. Like, she's sweating and nervous and she's going on stage and it's like she hasn't performed in an awful long time and she's very nervous. And later on, you kind of learn why she might be nervous. She's recently lost her dad and, her magic went away for a while where she couldn't speak backwards. So, Stevens is going to go there, hang out. And then coincidentally, this is just one of those superhero things that, it's not decompression. It's the opposite because it's just coincidentally, this religious group of firebringers goes to the theater to try to find this alchemist that knew her father, and he just happens to be in the crowd watching the show. So as Zatanna's she's doing the Mr. Miracle bit, like she's tied up in a straitjacket, a car is gonna drop on her. The car actually bursts into flames, and it's this religious group called the Firebringers, and it's like they have this power to use magic to have people like spontaneously combust, like and just burn up in flames. And they and Doc this new Fate, he doesn't even have a helmet. He just kind of has like the symbol of Nabu on his eye, and he jumps out to fight him with his daggers, and the Firebringers just kind of set him on fire, and it doesn't work because he's immune to when he chooses to be. He's immune to magic attacks or any form of magic. Like he's immune to like if Zatanna tried to do a spell on him and he was immune to it, he. It wouldn't work on him. So they get into like a fist fight, and then he realizes he's not on fire, and then Zatanna comes and starts fighting alongside of him, and they use their powers to and then that other chick shows up that and she starts fighting with Zatanna, and she and when she starts her name is Strega, and she's a scantily clad magician who starts fighting with Zatanna, and she thinks she's gonna beat Zatanna because she seems to be aware that she remembers that, hey, your magic backwards speaking ain't working anymore. And then she just starts using it, and she's like, holy shit, her magic's working again. And then you don't see any more of it because Zatanna does away with her pretty quickly. And then you meet that alchemist who knew her father, and he's like, I found the secret to alchemy, and I could turn something to gold. And that Strega comes back later, and she's actually turns her and the alchemist to gold because she actually touches him. He's like got the Midas touch, except he turns himself to gold. And the Firebringers end up getting destroyed. But it was a cool little issue. Like I enjoyed it. I like the art. It's a weird style. Like if you see the cover, that's the style. It's like a cross between Breyfogle and legs and arms don't necessarily look atomically correct. Like it's a looser style. It's pretty neat. I liked it. And just wanted to point out that this was the time that AOL teamed up with DC Comics America Online, and they had DC Comics Online, so you could go dial up and chat about your favorite comics. And a lot of the feedback they were getting in the letters pages were from cyberspace. Like it'll say like the person's name and say from CompuServe or like where it came from. Half the emails were still letters that they wrote in, and half of them were actually via the internet.
That's ridiculous. Who the fuck would want to talk about the comic books on the internet?
I don't know.
I looked up this Jared Stevens, Dr. Fate, and he is so 90s looking. Like he's so the 90s re-envisionment of a classic character.
It is true. It is very, very true.
So it doesn't necessarily mean that the stories are bad, but it's just that definitely I can definitely see that. He's got like there's a cover of the Book of Fate number one with him on it, and he's got a t-shirt on that says "Buy it, fanboy." There's another one where his t-shirt says "Eat quiche" for whatever reason. It's pretty weird.
I don't like I said, I don't remember. There's a reason I stopped buying it. And now I'm just going back to complete it, and I didn't mind it. I actually want to see what's going on. Like I have the rest of the issues so I can finish the series if I want. But it all depends on my mood. I keep switching.
The ink tattoo on his face is pretty cool, though.
Yeah.
I'll give him that.
And the daggers.
So,
It seems like they wanted to get away, like away from they considered like Dr. Fate at the time somebody who was like the Spectre or Superman, like he too powerful. And they wanted to like depower him, so they did like a Greatest American Hero thing. Like, you know how Greatest American Hero found his suit? And he didn't know how to, he didn't have the instruction manual. Well, that's kind of like Fate. He doesn't really necessarily know everything he's doing, and
That's true.
yeah. It's interesting if you ever get a chance to find it in a 50-cent bin. Check it out because it's not going to hurt you for 50 cents.
Yeah, I didn't really know about this incarnation of Dr. Fate, to be honest. It's kind of interesting. Well, speaking of 50 cent bins, I read a comic that I picked up from. Well, actually, I read more than one that I picked up from 50 cent bin, but this one is just kind of a one-off because it's a Marvel 2-in-1 issue from 1983. It's number 96, 60 cent cover price, and it has So this is a lot of times this is team ups with
What was the issue again, real quick?
96.
96, okay, thanks.
So 2-in-1 referring to you got 2-in-1 heroes. You know, you had the Thing teaming up with different superheroes, but this time it's a whole bunch of different heroes that appear. So it just says featuring the Thing, and it has the Thing laying in the hospital bed, and outside of his room, there's just this huge battle royal going on between all these heroes and all these villains, and then there's a nurse telling him to shh. And so that's what Visiting Hours is about, and basically, because it's written by Tom DeFalco with pencils by Ron Wilson and inks by Mike Esposito, and the Thing is in the hospital, and when it starts off, he's being visited by the Fantastic Four and Captain America and Iron Man, and it's basically, his battles have caught up with him. He fought the Gladiator, who dropped a bus on him in Fantastic Four 249, and then before he even got a chance to recover, he fought the Champion in Marvel 2-in-1 Annual Number 6. So he needs to recuperate, and he's got a nurse that's pretty crazy, and he calls her Nurse Hasslebutt because she won't let him smoke cigars or drink beer in the hospital.
That's awesome, because that's one time where they allowed him to smoke cigars.
Yeah, this is back when he was still doing that. So he gets some more visitors. Ben Foster shows up with his wife, I guess, Celia, and talks about how he's not, he's not Giant Man anymore. But basically word gets around that the Thing is in the hospital. And so different supervillains want to take advantage of the fact. And as different superheroes are on their way to visit him, they run into these different supervillains that are attacking. So Spider-Man's on his way with some $5 daisies, and he runs into this robot called the Mecho Marauder, and they end up fighting, and Spider-Man, keeps him from attacking, and then he, pops in through the window to give Thing his flowers, and but then Nurse Hasslebutt shows up and yells at Spider-Man for not having a visitor's pass because he came in through the window. And tries, so then, and she steals the cigar that somebody snuck in for a Thing. And then Daredevil goes up against Mirage, Master of Illusion. And the same kind of thing repeats where he stops him from coming in. And then, so at this point then, the Thing's by himself, and he goes to turn on the Yankees game, and finds out that it's canceled due to rain, and so the only thing that's on TV is a soap opera called One Life to Suffer. So then, once again, Mole Man comes up through the floor of the hospital and is on his way to attack, and Donald Blake, who at this time is the pseudonym of, or the alter ego of Thor. Thor ends up fighting Mole Man and using lightning to thunderstorm to scare the Mole Man and his Molides away. And it just kind of keeps going like that. Like the new Ant-Man fights a dude named Shellshock. And then probably the best one, though, is the Grapplers. I'd never heard of these, but it's four female professional wrestlers who apparently fought Thing back in Marvel 2-in-1 56. You got Screamin' Mimi, Marvel's version of Screamin' Mimi, I guess, Letha, Titania, and pound cakes. So
Titania, we know from like Secret Wars and stuff, right? Is that the same Titania?
I don't know. She looks different though, I think. I don't know if it's the same one, but so they end up running into Captain America on his way out, and you know, they think that they're going to be able to coordinate their attacks, but they're impressed with how versatile Captain America is with his hand-to-hand combat. But I mean, it's still 4-on-1, but fortunately the X-Men show up at that moment to give him a hand, and this is the era where it was Storm, Wolverine, Kitty Pryde, Nightcrawler, and yeah, that's it. That's the ones that show up. So while this is going on, things going pretty nuts. He's making paper airplanes and trying to fly them into the wastebasket nearby, and so then, you know, we see Dr. Doom is found out, and then basically at this point it escalates into this battle royal, because all these previous villains that have gotten beat and more are, including like MODOK flying above them, are stomping down the city street. So the Avengers and the X-Men and all the other heroes that we've seen so far band together as well, and they start battling it out in the streets, all because the Thing is in the hospital. And but we see a shadow entering the room, and one of the villains has slipped through. Thing says, "Who's there? You? No, it can't be." And then we say it's the Sandman, who snuck his way in, and using his, you know, powers of transforming into sand, he slithered his way through the vent system, and that's how he's able to get past everyone. And, you know, things like, yeah, save the explanations, I know how your powers work, I'm not impressed. And, you know, Sandman says, "Well, it's time you got what's coming to you, a box of cigars and a six-pack." So Sandman sits down, and they crack open some brewskis, and Thing starts smoking his cigar. And Sandman explains that he is trying to go legit, and he wants Thing to help him out. And Thing says, "Well, we can talk. You know, maybe this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship." And funny enough, like, I didn't realize that there was going to be this connection, but when I was reading that epic collection of Amazing Spider-Man, there's a point at which Sandman is in one of the issues and talks about how he's been going legit, and talks about how Thing will vouch for him because him and Thing have become buddies.
Yeah, I remember that time when he became legit, and I even think he joined like Silver Sable. Like, you know how Silver Sable was like mercenaries, they get paid to go do stuff, and she was always not a bad person. I think Sandman was part of that.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. So I thought that was pretty cool. Just a fun kind of silly issue.
Yeah, it's a great cover. He's there in bed and all hell's breaking loose outside.
Yeah, he's just sleeping. So that was pretty cool.
That is a cool issue. I don't have too many Marvel 2-in-1s. I've been looking for like a full run. I have like 89 through 100 and that's it.
Yeah,
I'm missing 96, ironically. So I have it pretty close, and then I'm missing 100. But I don't have a lot of it. And then I started to buy The Thing, which this issue, this title became The Thing, like its own title when he went off into space. She-Hulk became part of the Fantastic Four. He went off into space and did his thing.
Oh, right.
And kind of like, we've had a lot of those stories, like the Hulk goes off into space, Superman goes off into space, and then they're in space for, they're not on Earth for a long period of time. But that's cool. I look out for that one.
Yeah, the funny thing about those stories is that none of them are really realistic to my experiences in space. Times that I've spent out in space, my adventures have been nothing.
Yours are
like
more
that.
Like Buck Rogers.
Yeah, yeah.
You sit there cold and dreaming of sexy women.
Yeah. Maybe that's why, maybe with the comics code and everything like that back then, they couldn't depict my adventure.
You can't depict them, that's right.
No,
So,
not comic code approved.
on my journey to try to find all the appearances of Red Wolf, I had made a couple of eBay purchases, and I bought Avengers number 80, which is the first appearance of Red Wolf, and number 81, which wraps up the story. I had recently got his single issues, and those take place in the past, but his first appearance was in the Avengers, and the tales that I was reading were of his ancestor, so in the Western time. So this is an interesting time in the Avengers, a time of the Avengers that I don't have a lot of the issues. This is when the cover price was 15 cents, and the year is 1970. So the creative team is Roy Thomas with art by John Buscema, and the inker is Tom Palmer. And this is the coming of the Red Wolf. And it opens up that Red Wolf is tracking down a guy with a gun, and you don't know why he's tracking him down. And the guy's running out of panic, and Red Wolf is going to kill him, like he's seeking vengeance. And the Vision shows up, and the Vision's like, "What's happening? I can't let this guy kill this innocent guy with a gun." So the Vision intervenes. And he actually, the Vision's a powerful dude, man. I mean, the fact that he can phase through almost anything and then change his density, he actually phases his arm into Red Wolf's chest, and then just barely solidifies it enough to not kill him, but knock him out like totally. And he knocks Red Wolf out, and the dog attacks him, Lobo. Lobo is like pissed, like, "Why did you take out my master?" But I guess Lobo realizes that Vision isn't going to kill him, and he's taking him back to Avengers Mansion. And ironically enough, Vision was just, he had just quit the Avengers. He had just said, "I'm done with the Avengers, I'm leaving them," and just happened to run into Red Wolf, and then he's on his way back to the Avengers Mansion, where the rest of the Avengers are around a table, and they're trying to be proactive, and they want to go after the God, what is this group's name? Zodiac. So the Zodiac team, they want to go after them, and the team is like Iron Man, Thor, Captain America, Black Panther, Goliath, Scarlet Witch, Quicksilver. So they got quite a big roster at the time, and Goliath at this time is not Hank Pym. I think it's when Hawkeye became Clint Barton became Goliath for a short time, and the Vision brings in Red Wolf, and Red Wolf comes and he tells his backstory, and his backstory is that this mobster went back to his home and tried to take to buy the land, and his father didn't want to sell the land, and so he killed his father. And now he's seeking vengeance. So once his father was dead, he kind of went to the mountain, and he always knew the tale of the Dance of the Red Wolf, and he actually became Red Wolf. And the way he got Lobo was interesting, because the mother of Lobo attacked Red Wolf because she had that parental instinct, like, "You ain't gonna take my baby." And Red Wolf killed the mother, which is pretty sad because I'm a dog lover. He killed the mother to get the cub, and the cub became Lobo. And then he went to seek vengeance against them in New York. And the Vision stopped that, so now he's there. And at this time, the Avengers are, man, they don't like each other very much. It seems like they have different versions or different visions of what the Avengers should be. And it's like Cap, Iron Man, and Thor want to be proactive and go after big threats like Zodiac. And Black Panther's like, "Fuck this. We got enough problems in our backyard. Let's take care of some of the stuff that's happening in our schools, like the school shootings and stuff." And then we got the other faction who just wants to go help help Red Wolf. So that's Vision and Goliath and Scarlet Witch. So at the end of this issue, they go off. They all go off in their separate paths. And the next issue just continues that storyline where they go off on their separate paths. They don't really talk about the Zodiac, but they do focus on the Vision, Goliath, and Scarlet Witch team with Red Wolf, where they go after the gangster. And the gangster has recently he's like so rich that he bought like he can program starships with robots flying them, attack the Quinjet, and blow it out of the sky. And the Vision is captured. Scarlet Witch is captured. Goliath and Red Wolf are nowhere to be found. And when they capture him, I guess Wanda's powers are kind of like depowered right now. Like she can't charge up her hex powers, and they kind of use her as a damsel in distress, which kind of sucks because they use her to get to the Vision. And the gangster says, "If you don't work for me, I'm gonna kill the Scarlet Witch." So there's a short battle between the Vision and Goliath and Red Wolf, but it gets all wrapped up. They end up taking down the gangsters, which they're heavily armed, and he goes back to his people, Red Wolf, and he's kind of redeemed because he got vengeance for his father. But the guy that he went after, the lead gangster, mobster, he kind of just you don't know what happened to him. He was washed away, and nor do you know why he wanted that Indian land. There's something there that he's trying to mine or get, and I guess we'll find out in future issues. So that was Avengers number 81 or 80 and 81, the first appearance of Red Wolf. Same creative team on the second issue.
Do you know the last time that Red Wolf was really around in comics?
Yeah, I mean, I always saw him with the Texas Rangers, which were like a superhero team in the Hulk. They were like the Southwestern super team. But I haven't seen him around recently.
Yeah, I'm not super familiar with
Yeah, I just go off on some weird ass tangents. I'm like, "Oh,
them.
Red Wolf, I could get a full run of that. What is that?" And then I just dig into it until I finish it. I did the same thing with Man-Wolf and
Yeah, you're around a wolf guy.
Frankenstein, yeah, and Werewolf by Night I'm still working on. But close to finishing that.
Yeah, there can't be that many people out there that intentionally put together a collection of all of Red Wolf's
Yeah.
appearances. It's probably being unique in that
I
respect.
could write an issue for a back issue magazine.
That'd be sweet.
There you go.
So some more stuff that I got. I put on Twitter, if you go to my Twitter, MythMakingETC, I put like four photos of my last batch of 50 cent pickups that I got. Not a lot of stuff, but among those were the first three issues of Power of the Atom, which this series was new to me. This is from like the late 80s, and it only ran for 18 issues. So I grabbed the first three to try it out, see how I liked it. And also because I don't think issue four was at least I wasn't able to find issue four, but I think there were some more issues. I'll probably grab those and then just fill in the whatever ones are missing, because I did like these. These are this is the Ray Palmer Atom, and it follows like Sword of the Atom and stuff. These are written by Roger Stern, who's a writer I like from the Avengers and Cap and stuff, from Marvel stuff, and then the pencils are by Dwayne Turner. But so the background behind this story or going into this series was that the Atom was permanently small and he had taken up residence in an alien society in the Brazilian jungle. So basically these aliens had come to Earth, and in the process of coming to Earth had shrunk down to really small size, but didn't really realize it because they're just arriving on Earth and it's an alien planet and they don't know what size they're supposed to be or what size things are supposed to be. And Ray has left his marriage with Jean Loring, and being that he can't control his size anymore, he is essentially planning to live out his life in this with this alien culture in this city that they're calling New Morla Day. He's fallen in love with one of the princess of that group, Princess Laithwin, and he's become really good friends with this guy named Voss. So they when the story starts, though, he comes rocketing out of the handset of a phone that has rung in the house of his old friend Norman Brawler, and he comes rocketing out, and he's getting bigger as he comes out of the hole in the receiver, so it smashes the top of the phone to bits, and he continues to grow and then stops at the height of 3 feet. So a lot of the first issue is kind of like Ray telling the story to Norman of how what happened in between him arriving there and him leaving the society, where some foresters came and started burning the jungle and essentially destroyed the alien culture and the princess and Voss. And Ray's the only one that survives, and he goes to take revenge on the foresters that did it, and has like sort of a battle with them, and as a last ditch effort to survive, he shrinks down. He's able to control his size again suddenly, because he brought with him a piece of a white dwarf star that was in the alien city, and was responsible for them shrinking down. Ultimately, he found that he was able to control this piece of white dwarf star, so he takes it with him, and it allows him to control his size again. That kind of catches us up with the present day, and comprises the first issue ultimately, other than Ray realizing that the place that he's ended up, where his friend Norman Brawler is living, is actually his old house. And his identity is public because he never planned to come back to society. So he and Jean allowed Norman to write a book about their relationship and Ray's career as the Atom in the Justice League and stuff. So his identity has been made public, and the Central Intelligence Agency is aware of his return and is monitoring him to see what he's going to do. So the second and third issues are concerned with Ray trying to figure out how to control his size again, and he goes back to the physics lab where a former student of his that we find out was secretly in love with him. She helps him to get his size under control, and they build a new costume for him that has this kind of like telepathic, like he's able to use kind of his mind.
Isn't the white dwarf in his belt though?
I think that's part of it or something like that. He works all night trying to develop this new costume, and he has some leftover because his costume's missing, so he has to make a new costume, and there's still some fabric left from his old costume in the in the storage there at the university. There's some kind of like this is the costume where his hair is sticking out over the top, but and the coloring on the costume is a little bit different. His legs are blue instead of red, but it has circuitry and stuff in the helmet that helps him to control his size.
What was the woman's name? Just out of curiosity, do you remember what that is?
Yeah, I have it here.
His new assistant.
Enrica Negrini.
Okay, I wanted to see if it rang a bell.
Yeah, so she was his student, and then like later on, he's recuperating and sleeping, and she's thinking, you know, everyone used to be jealous when I was your assistant, all the other women grad students, because you're so handsome, and but you know, they didn't. But he was the only woman in his life at the time was Jean Loring, and there could be no other woman in his life. But now she's thinking maybe she has a chance and stuff. But so the university gets attacked by terrorists, and the Atom. So he goes off to take care of that, and it turns out that the Central Intelligence Agency were actually the ones that are behind, getting the terrorists. Don't really know that they're being used this way, but the terrorists. Are being used by a Central Intelligence Agency to monitor the Atom's abilities. And because he takes down these terrorists, he ends up on TV, and so people know that he's back, including a fellow named Strobe, who's this kind of a joke supervillain, but he's jealous of the media attention. So issue 3 involves a battle with him, but he pretty much doesn't really know what he's doing. But we also find out that Jean Loring and her new husband, Mr. Hoban, become aware of the fact that Ray's back, and Jean's pretty upset by his return, thinking that, you know, she was never going to see him again, and that she was, you know, he was out of her life for good.
That bitch. Well, I know of what she eventually does, so I'm like.
Mm-hmm. I know her name's familiar. I'm kind of
Jean Loring from Identity Crisis, man.
She's
She's the bitch that caused everything.
Oh yeah.
She killed Sue Dibney.
No Identity Crisis.
Ah, damn. Psychotic woman.
But So Adam's having to adjust with the reality of not having a secret identity and stuff, and as a result, like, a lot of people are hounding the people that he knows. Like, he's having to deal with all the reporters and everything, and thinking, you know, maybe he shouldn't stick around Ivy Town, and which is, you know, my village, and so he's contemplating that when he gets a call from the CIA. They finally contact him, so instead of just answering the phone, he actually travels through the phone and pops out in their office, and they're a little freaked out at first, but you know, he doesn't know the CIA has been kind of manipulating things and have been spying on him, but because they want to manipulate him into such a place in his life where he doesn't really have much choice but work for them. The irony of that is, I mean, Ray's pretty willing to help out and work for the government just because, you know, he wants to serve the country, and he's sort of dude that just wants to do the right thing. So he's pretty willing to sign up, at least at this point. And that's where issue 3 ends up. But yeah, I like these. I'm definitely going to pick up the rest of the run.
Cool. Was that your comic shop that you got them from?
No, you know, there's this bookstore. Sometimes they sell their stuff for $1, but for a long time now they've had it on like 2 for $1.
Yeah.
And every once in a while I'll pop in there when I have a little bit of time and go through a couple boxes. It's if it were more than 50 cents, I would be annoyed by the fact that they're not really in order. They're in order by publisher. Like, the Marvel and DC stuff tends to be together, and the independent stuff tends to be together. But You could tell they used to be in order a long time ago, because you'll hit pockets of a run of something. So it depends on what mood I'm in. Sometimes I kind of just like flip through idly, because I don't want to look at every single one. I get annoyed at the fact that they're not in order. But then sometimes I'm just in the mood to browse and discover things. So
cool deal.
Those were, yeah, so those were kind of grouped together. So I could, I know if I go back, I know how to, I can just find the other ones that I didn't pick up, because there was a pocket of Atom comics together.
Yeah, the probability of them being there is high.
Mm-hmm.
I have that run. Yeah, it's a good run.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Any other books that you've read?
Is that it for you, or
that's it for me?
Well, I'll just talk about to wrap up. I'll just talk about another Epic collection, because I in the last 2 weeks I read the other one that I had, which was the Thor one. This was actually the second one to come out, but I skipped over it and read the Spider-Man one, which was the third one to come out. And this is called War of the Pantheons, and it's Thor 383 through 400. So it's pretty much all written, except for I think maybe one issue by Tom DeFalco again. Most of it's penciled by Ron Frenz.
I like him.
Yeah, though there's a lot of different inkers.
I find Ron Frenz has a Bronze Age feel to it.
Yeah,
like I just like it. It just the line work. Like he did a lot of Spider Girl, you know, with DeFalco.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, and I think I don't know if he always does, but DeFalco's writing almost has a Bronze Age feel to it.
Oh yeah, I totally agree. I would have never ever thought I'd read Spider-Girl, but I happened to read one issue and I'm like, what the hell is this? it had like an old school feel to it, and I was like, I want to read more.
Yeah, because there's definitely like people will have long thought bubbles where they think the plot to themselves so that the reader's caught up. And things like that that you wouldn't really see in modern comics. And I don't even know, like, because these are actually from 87 to 89, these range. So, but it is good storyline. Like, they are good storylines. I mean, it's called War of the Pantheons because the bulk of it is the storyline where the Egyptian god Seth is seeking to take over Asgard. So most of it involves that, though. It starts off with a couple issues before that storyline gets rolling. Like 383 is an untold tale from the Secret Wars.
Yeah, the Wrecking Crew. God, I love the Wrecking Crew.
Yeah, and
there's Titania on there too.
Yeah,
I was just talking about her. So she doesn't look like that.
No.
Okay.
I don't think. Let me see. No, it's not that. Yeah, it's. So I don't know if it's supposed to be the same person and she dressed up different, or if it's just using the same name.
Mm.
But the Titania that hangs out with Absorbing Man a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, she doesn't look like that in Marvel Team Up. 384 is actually, though, like a really cool one-shot. It's the creative team that I mentioned. The inker in this case is Brett Breeding. But it's a future tale. It takes place in the year 2537. And it doesn't feature Thor per se, but it's a futuristic society where a young guy ends up being worthy to pick up Mjolnir and uses the power of Thor, because Mjolnir has ended up stranded in this era. So he uses the power of Thor and kind of becomes like sort of like a futuristic looking Thor. His name's Dargo. So he picks it up and ends up using the power of Thor to fight off Loki. And then at the end of the story, He sends Mjolnir through this portal off into to return to its true master. But if anyone's looking for like a fun back issue that's a done in one, Thor 384 is a cool different story than you typically expect from a Thor book that still connects into the whole mythos and stuff. But 385 is kind of the last sort of one-off issue done in one before you really get rolling with the plot that follows the rest of the trade. And this is actually a tale from the past, which is pretty interesting because it's a Jim Shooter plot with a Stanley script, and the penciler is Eric Larson with Vince Coletta inks. But if you scrutinize it, at times looks like Eric Larson, but it really doesn't look like what you typically expect later on from Eric Larson's style. If maybe it's the inks that mm-hmm. changed it, but it's pretty different looking for Eric Larson. But yeah, once we get to 386, we get rolling with the overall plot, and basically this is a time where Odin has been missing from Asgard and really kind of not expected to be found, and he's been gone for a long time, and like we later find out that he's been gone since like Thor 350 something. So he's been gone for a few years and missing, and people don't really know why. And along the way, Thor has some adventures where he teams up with the pantheon of Celtic gods, and at first, is antagonistic with Lear, the Lord of Lightning. But ends up helping him out so that there's some like camaraderie between the two of them, which ends up playing in things later on. And Thor battles some celestials, things kind of, they sort of take their time to develop. Like, so Baldur is the one that's in charge of Asgard in Odin's absence. And Thor ends up stuck on Earth for a little while. And this also is the era where there's the Earth Force that's created by Seth. And they're like three ordinary people who end up, taking on the power of these different birds. Like there's a policeman. It kind of reminded me of the Black Rider, where he's like a policeman who's in a coma, and a normal housewife, and Winston Manchester, who's a businessman, and they become Wind Warrior, Skyhawk, and Earth Lord. So they're initially set against Thor by Seth, and but he ends up, they end up turning good. And so they end up like being appended to the overall story, and Black Knight is featured throughout as a part of like the group that's on Thor's side. And Black Knight at this point, he's got the blood curse where he's slowly fusing with his armor and becoming a living weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of like a crossover continuity from Avengers, and he's keeping that a secret from Thor and the other allies and stuff. But it really kind of over time really escalates into a pretty epic storyline. At the end of 398, Odin is finally found. It's a really cool moment where so he's been gone like 40 issues, and so it's a pretty neat moment where Thor finds him chained up, and we end up getting some backstory about what happened. I would say that probably art-wise, my favorite issue, because it's all Ron Frenz, but I say the inker changes a lot throughout, and you can see a difference at times. My favorite issue is probably 399 art-wise, because that was that issue has inks by Romeo Tangal, and the combination of the two artists, it really has a Kirby feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
there's a really cool splash page where double page splash actually where it's New York in the bottom, and there's just this like kind of crosshatched shadowy clouds that have the suggestion of warriors and battles, and like the people on the street in New York are, you know, wondering what's going on. And a father tells his son, you know, it's just a sign. He gives him a scientific explanation, but secretly he knows that there's probably something else going on, because he's the dude, what's his name, that ends up becoming Thor later on, then Thunderstrike.
Eric something. Eric?
Yeah.
I can't remember his last name.
Yeah, so because he's earlier on, he's introduced as a character during this era, but he doesn't become Thor or anything like that in this trade, but he's introduced as a character, as a sub-character during this time.
What does Kara think of you reading comics? Does she, like, appreciate it, or does she think it's weird, or...
Mm-mm, no. Like, when we first started dating, I told her in that kind of, hey, you know, I'm sort of, like, into comics a little kind of thing, and she's like, why did you tell me that so awkwardly? It's like, I don't think that's weird. She doesn't read a lot of superhero comics, but she was already into like
Vertigo?
Yeah, or like trying to think of a good example, like Persepolis.
Oh, okay, the graphic novel award winning books.
That kind of stuff. And she'd met like Mouse.
Uh-huh.
She met the guy that did that. I sound really knowledgeable by not remembering his name. and stuff like that, and like different graphic novels, and like actually a number of things, you know, like
Spiegelman.
Art Spiegelman, yeah. The stuff of that nature that Bill talks about on Geek Brunch, mm-hmm. the regular Geek Brunch, he's talked about stuff that I've thought, oh, Kara might like that, and then I'll tell her and she'll have already heard about it. Or in one case, I forget what it was, but I told her something he was talking about that I thought she would like, and she said, yeah, don't you remember the like couple weeks that I was reading that next to you in bed? I'm like, oh yeah, totally. So she likes that stuff, although, you know, and she has read some superhero stuff of mine at times when the New 52 first started and I was really into it. She was reading along with Batman and a couple other things for a little while there, and she really liked Batwoman, mm-hmm. like the J.H. Williams art. She read some of the New 52 Batwoman, but then I gave her the Detective Comics run with the Greg Rucka writing.
Yeah.
And she especially liked those even more, like with the Greg Rucka writing.
It was deeper. There was a lot more in there, the crime Bible and all kinds of shit going on.
Yeah, so that was one of the probably the favorite things that I've given her superhero wise that she's read, though. But yeah, no, she totally she's cool with it.
Right on.
Yeah. But yeah, so I would recommend the storyline with Thor, you know.
Yeah, it sounds like you're really getting your money's worth on those epic books. You're reading through them pretty fast.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see, you know, when my tastes change or whatever, if I keep picking them up, but I'm still into them right now. I just got the most recent one that came out the end of December is the first Avengers one, and that's
where do you get them from? Amazon, or
I've been getting them on Amazon. Yeah. I've still been like, I haven't been reading any new single issues lately, but I've still been putting in orders with DCBS for trades that come out, mostly Image trades that come out, because I am still interested in picking up and reading those, although lately I really haven't read much new stuff. But the only reason I haven't really been pre-ordering the Epic Collection stuff, because I haven't been sure if at some point I'll stop feeling interested in them.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, like if I'm like I have a pile here of new trades to check out, and most of them are like volume ones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I know I'll grab those, and I have time, and you know, you have like 6 months or so probably before volume two is even going to be solicited, so I have plenty of time to tell if I want the new one or not.
Right.
I got like Ghosted and Five Weapons and Five Ghosts and Sheltered and Sex.
Lots of, you got Sex?
I got Six. I think it's written by George Michael or something.
Yeah, I want your Sex. I like that one. That one's like a superhero guy that retired or kind of thing comes back. I like that. And then Sex Criminals, that's a good one too.
Yeah, I read the first issue of that.
Five Weapons is really good. I just haven't finished it. I can't explain why, because it's so freaking good. I've been in different moods.
Yeah, wasn't that the one on Geek Brunch that you guys all liked?
Oh, yeah, I loved it. James Robinson, yeah. Jimmy Robinson.
Jimmy Robinson, yeah.
Yeah. I just want to say that I think, like, in an early episode of this, I started The Witching, which was almost breaking our rule. It's, like, from 2005. Mm. And I finished it. I went and bought... I had found, like, 1 through 5 in a 25-cent bin or something. Uh-huh. And I really liked it. It's a Vertigo title. And it was by Jonathan Vankin. And I went and bought from My Comic Shop number 6 through 10. And I love this series, man. It's crazy. It's about three witches that come together to fight a religious cult. And I just wanted to point out that there's this general in here that is out to destroy the three witches. And it actually killed one of the witches' fathers. And he's, like, profane and vulgar, and he cusses like nobody's business. And I just wanted to give you a sampling of, like, what comes out of this guy's mouth, because it's hilarious. So the scene takes place in White Sands Missile Range, New Mexico. And he's like, "Elsa Grimson, God damn it!" And that's one of the witches. He says, "You cocksucking motherfucking mine!" And then one of his soldiers says, "We're finished here, General." And he goes, "I can see that, God damn it! Do these look like ox testicles in my head?" He's referring to his eyes. And he says, "No, sir. Goddamn right, they're eyes, and they still work. I can scope a pair of D-cups at 600 meters. Now, where's the goddamn witchfinder general to activate this contraption?" And then some guy says, "There's been a delay, General. Seems the administration has deployed the witchfinder unit to Iraq." "What the fuck? What goddamn delay? Sweet jizzing Jesus! Oh, I've never liked that Peckerwood anyway. Get this shit box fired up, then get your asses ready for the arrival of Elsa goddamn Grimston." He just, it's like every word that comes out is offensive.
Oh, God. Let's make sure we earned our explicit tag this time.
Yeah, we earned it.
Wow, I like that. Ox testicles line.
Yeah, he's like, "These look like ox testicles in my head."
Next time Kara asks me if I saw something. Yeah. Like, "Of course I did. These look like ox testicles in my head."
Yeah, this series is so much fun. I'm so glad that I found it. As I'm going through different time periods of old comics, it's so interesting just looking at the ads too, because right now modern comics has like no advertising except their own. Do you know what I mean? They're just advertising other comics, but
yeah, pretty much.
Man, these 2005 heavy on the video games, like incredible amount of video game stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's because it's a fairly recent change.
Yeah, but if you ever find The Witching in a quarter bin, it's well worth, especially if you're like into The Coven or, you know, like American Horror Story.
Mm-hmm.
Such an interesting group of witches. They're, one of them, you know, is like a moon goddess, and one of them is like a rock star that has can only power her witch powers through a stuffed cat. And then there's and she's like a rock star that can't succeed without her boyfriend. And there's another one that's just like a Asian punk rocker that her father was been trying to protect her whole time, but it's just a cool story, man. And then they all come together at the end. I really enjoyed it.
Cool.
So much fun. The art
Yeah,
is
I do remember you talking about
spectacular
that one.
too, man. The art is amazing. I really like it.
Nice.
So that's all I had. Do you have anything else?
No, that's pretty much it. I mean, because, there's quite a few issues in that Thor trade. I just kind of talked about the whole thing, but,
383 through 400.
Yeah. But yeah, it definitely 399 and 400 definitely has a really strong finish to it. It gets pretty epic. And then it also includes all of issue 400, so it has some backstories, which I haven't read those yet. I got to the end of the regular storyline in issue 400, and then it has each of these epic collections has a few like little extras in the back. It's usually not much, just a couple pages. Like this has a Fred Hembeck strip from Marvel Age Annual, and then it has a 2-page interview with Ron Frenz, which was originally in Marvel Age 64, and it has a few pinups from like Marvel Fanfare, and like part of the story was originally released in a trade paperback called "Alone Against the Centennial or Celestials," and so they have the cover of that. So it usually just has like a couple pages of some stuff like that in the back of these, and then the inside back cover shows you the cover of the next volume in the Epic Collection. So that would be that.
Cool deal. Well, we are located at geekbrunchpodcast.com, and you can reach us at Twitter at @MythMakingETC or @MikeMyersBrunch. That's our Twitter accounts, and we have our Facebook page is Geek Brunch, Geek Space Brunch Space Podcast. You can click the like button. Please, if you get a chance, leave an iTunes review. You just type in Geek Brunch, search for the Geek Brunch, and then you can leave a review there, write a review, and that helps us get more listeners or get more visibility within the app. And we have a forum for geeks, the Geek Brunch thread. You can always leave comments that way. And da, 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 da. You can leave comments on the website itself. I think that's everything. And you want to plug your podcast?
Oh yeah, Mythmaking ETC is the podcast. This week I released an episode about Green Lantern issue 123. That's the most recent. That's when Green Lantern stopped being Green Lantern and Green Arrow and became Green Lantern again. And started being more about like science fiction, outer space type stuff after doing the like traveling heroes thing with Green Arrow on Earth for a while. It's just a short 15-20 minute show. Usually I talk about one issue, sometimes two. You can check that out.
Good
Daryl just
deal.
I was distracted because Daryl Taylor sent me a message on Skype saying that beet burgers stink. So I'm learning. So I took as an ending note, I took 2 semesters of Spanish in college, for general ed requirements, and I don't know the teaching method. I just found it really difficult. But lately, I downloaded this Duolingo app on my iPhone that you can use to learn different languages, and it makes it kind of like a game, like you earn experience points and stuff.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and it actually is working way better. I've actually been enjoying it, and I actually kind of like you can set it to go like do 10 minutes a day or 20 minutes a day. So I just have it like set at 10 minutes a day, and actually like look forward to doing it and stuff. So, so I responded to Daryl in Spanish and said, "Yo no carno, or yo no como carne, yo soy vegetariano."
And he's like, "What the fuck?"
So he'll be like, "Did I send this to the wrong person?"
he'll say WTF is what he'll say.
Yeah, and then FML.
And then he'll start. He's like, he'll start getting angry.
Yeah.
He always texts me when he's listening to Geek Brunch and Micah and them are talking about vegetarian dishes. He gets so mad.
Yeah, it was the worst when I was on there instead of you.
Yeah.
I talked all about veganism and stuff.
Yeah.
And got them. I encouraged them instead of like you provide a counterpoint to. And Micah and Bill, but I was just right in there with them. It was like vegetarian fest.
Well, Micah is like, he sees both sides. Like, he'll eat anything. Like, Micah right. will have a burger.
Yeah.
And he'll have meat. So yeah. He's like the in-between. And then there's Bill, who's almost a vegetarian, other than he'll eat fish.
That's like a certain kind of vegetarianism.
Yeah.
I have fish. Occasionally, I have seafood occasionally.
Mm-hmm. I had a falafel. It was weird.
I love falafel.
I don't think I'll ever eat one again unless it's out there and there's nothing else to eat.
I mean, I don't really eat falafel plain. I usually have it with hummus, or a lot of times if I have falafel, it's like a falafel wrap.
Yeah.
You know, and it has hummus and lettuce, tomato, and stuff like that in there, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because it can be kind of dry on its own.
I didn't find it dry. It just, I don't know, the texture was just freaking weird. It was like eating a chorizo, except it wasn't that. It was like a deep-fried something, and then there's something in it. But it had a weird texture to it.
Mm-hmm.
At least to me.
Mm-hmm. I can see the chorizo comparison. The flavor is a lot different, but
it's got that spicy chorizo flavor. It's interesting. I ate three of them. Or four.
Yeah, I mean, I like Mediterranean. I go through tons of hummus.
I wasn't a fan of the Mediterranean. My brother had that for my nephew's birthday.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was trying new things, but I just didn't care for it. I like the rice, whatever they did with the rice. It was like a yellowish, spicy rice.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I saw Barb post a picture of you in your high chair with cake all over your face.
Yeah.
At least I think that was you.
That was me. No.
Or maybe I was your nephew. I don't know.
All right. Well, you have a good week. And
you too.
Tackle the next episode of Buck Rogers next week, or in 2 weeks.
Yeah, do you want to just, I see it's a two-parter again. Do you want to just do the two-parter?
I can do the two-parter.
All right.
All right.
Good.
All right, talk to you later.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah.